Hello, everybody. This is Jeremy Swenson. I am the CEO of Abstract Forward Consulting. We are a cybersecurity process improvements and technology change management consulting firm based out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Today's podcast is centered around change management as well as project leadership, and we have an international renowned guest on that very topic.
Suzanne Madsen, the author of The Power of Project Leadership and the Project Management Coaching Workbook.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for having me on your podcast. Yes, that's right. I'm speaking here from London in the UK. I have been working with project and program management for coming up to, well, I think between 20 and 25 years. I try to stop counting these days. And I've been a consultant in the beginning of my career. Then I joined a financial institution in London, been running some large business critical programs for them. And in the last 10 years, I've really been interested in more the human side of things. I qualified as a coach 10 years ago, and I began to coach other project managers in parallel with my day job. But for the last 6 years, almost 6 years now, I've been doing this as my own business. So what I do today is that I coach project managers, I run training in project leadership, and as I said, specifically that human side of project management.
Change management is really based on Kotter's from Harvard, John Kotter's change management model, his process, if you will. And I wrote a blog post on that some time ago. I cited your summary of that because he does a great job. But could you just go ahead and, for our audience, in your expert opinion, just summarize what is Kotter's change management model and how does that work?
Kotter's change management model is one of the most popular out there on the market, and it consists of 8 steps that I can briefly summarize. The first step is to create urgency. And what Kotter really means here is that as a change, the people implementing change, the senior managers in an organization, they really need to create a compelling case. They need to explain why this change is necessary. Because if people don't understand why the change is necessary, they're not going to buy into it in the first place. The second step in Kotter's model is to create a powerful coalition. And what he means there is that we need a number of people who can serve as change agents or champions, or whatever you want to call it, is these early adopters almost that we use in the lingo we use in other parts, which is people who can go out there and be the change, who can show the way, if you like. And so another way of saying it is that you need allies. His third step is to create a vision for the change. So people really crave certainty and information. So people want to know, what is it, where is it we're moving towards, what is the vision? And it's not just any vision here that's important. It's important that we have a vision which is clear, short, concise, and a vision preferably which appeals to people's emotions. So the most effective way of communicating with people is if I feel involved, if it speaks to me. So that's really what he is talking about here in the third step. The fourth step is to then communicate the vision, because of course it's no good to have a vision if people are not hearing about it. You know, that's sometimes what happens in an organization. Well, the vision is there, people just haven't heard of it. So the communicating the vision, this fourth step, is about writing about it in emails, it's about communicating it in person, and it's about mentioning it at every opportune moment. So it's not a one-off exercise. It's something that organizational leaders and those who are heading up the change should refer to often. And preferably, if they can, you know, set a good example themselves, that's even better.
I wanted to just ask a quick question here on communicate the vision. It seems like to me at large bureaucratic organizations, communication can end up meaning different things to different parts of the business. And I think so that can be very hard to communicate the vision, especially, again, when there's so many different parts of the business and different parts of the country where it just doesn't always mean the same thing. How do you overcome that challenge?
I think that's a good point, because we all perceive things differently. So to me, a good vision is one that speaks to all of those different stakeholders, if you use that terminology of stakeholders. So if there are people who need to hear a certain thing from the vision in order to be brought in, and another person who needs, or another group of people who need to hear another part, I think the vision needs to be encompassing enough that it speaks to different types of people. If it only speaks to senior management in an organization, you will lose the employees and vice versa. So that would be my advice. Have a broad enough vision that it speaks to several people. And then another thing is, sometimes, not just in regards to this topic, but generally people speak in jargon and they talk about concepts. And jargon and concepts can be misunderstood or understood in different ways. So I think it's very important that a vision is clear, so that we use common sense language, down-to-earth, good plain English, rather than hiding behind terminology, because then there's a bigger chance that people will understand the same thing.
Yeah, that sounds like a good answer. Still, it's a very hard thing to do, because I know, I think how people communicate a vision of a change can be tied into their fears, which I know you know a lot about as well. But if I'm an employee or a director of a certain line of a business, and I fear that this vision is going to have a change that's going to outsource part of my work or affect my reporting structure, then my interpretation of this so-called vision may be different than somebody else who's in a different part of the business. And I think that's where a lot of good stories and town halls and making the lay employees involved in the communications, having the sessions where they sit down and brainstorm, what does this mean for you and how would you communicate this to your chain?
Yes.
Executive management has a different view of it than, the different layers of management and the different wings of the business. So, I mean, getting them involved in the town halls and then having them re-communicate it in their way for their people, because there's different subcultures within different parts of the business, as you well know. And communication is everything. I mean, so the biggest challenges that I've faced on projects were never around, the actual competencies and business skills and the technicalities. They were always around miscommunication and somebody getting ruffled because they're interpreting something to mean something different. And there's an insecurity there, and there's a fear. So I'm going to let you finish the review of the change management model here. But I just wanted to offer that commentary, and then also drop in the back of your mind this concept of fear. And I'm sure you can weave in some comments to what you've seen with fear and change management, because it's a big part of it.
Yeah, and it's a very good comment you had there, and it actually leads into the fifth topic or the fifth point here in Kotler's model, because The fifth step is to remove obstacles. And even though we have communicated the vision, it is not enough. And it's funny that you talk about people cascading the vision down. I don't think you use that word, but sometimes when people cascade the vision down, you let individuals do it, then it is also subject to misinterpretation in that cascade. So I think we need multiple approaches to communicating the vision. One is, we need to hear it from the top, and then also a cascade, so that we can kind of double check those two things. And you're quite right. In when it's communicated further down or cascaded further down, there's a dialogue that is needed. And this is exactly what Kotler is talking about in the fifth step, which is remove obstacles. Here, it's essentially about listening to people's fears, concerns, and create a feedback loop so that it becomes a dialogue rather than just, top down, because top down, it can feel like a push. This is what we have to do. So to really work with the emotions, to work with, obstacles is quite a hard word, but to create that dialogue where we ask people, how does this sound to you? What does this bring up for you? What does this do for you? What other suggestions do you have? That's really, really important. And that's really what the fifth step is about. And we can go back and talk more about that, because I think this is where the crux of it actually lies in really overcoming resistance to change, which is in the emotions. But let me go through the last step. So step number six is to create short-term wins. And this is really about beginning, as people are beginning to say, okay, I understand, maybe this is a good change here. I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. Then your users want to see some benefits, some tangible benefits. So you could also call it some quick wins or low-hanging fruit or whatever. So we need to begin to deliver something so that people can see that this change is for the better. And the seventh step is what Cutter calls to build on the change. So here we need to keep delivering, keep communicating, not just have some kind of radio silence or not use the change we've implemented. We need to build on it, reinforce it, and keep delivering positive change. And the last one is to anchor the changes, which is really just more of that. It is to really use what we've delivered to embed it into everyday practices, into our operating models, so that it becomes the new way of doing it. So that's kind of broadly what the eight steps are. And I think the fifth step, remove obstacles, is really the one where we talk about fears and emotions.
Now that we know what Cutter's change management model consists of, I think what we should talk about next is what you've seen in your experience. And I can talk a little bit about my experience too on projects where there were some pitfalls or misunderstandings that held the project back, or you know, were challenges, but they were overcome. And you know, if you didn't overcome it, that's fine too. There's always a lesson learned there. But yeah, again, let's just talk about those pitfalls and how to overcome those. So I guess I'll start with a little story from, you know, my time at a financial institution, and maybe this will inspire some of your case recollection. So I was at a large financial institution on a large data migration project, which was a change, which had a restructure as a part of it. You know, so you're talking about a big part of the business is going to be laid off, right? So that's always hard. That's people's jobs. That's a change people don't want to have to swallow. And then you can't really talk about it. You have to keep it quiet. The communication was the biggest challenge, because every single time we did a migration of these different contact center offices, we had to go and have meetings with the leadership of that office and give them information about what was going to happen and build a rapport with them and essentially give them bad news, you know, that you know their office is going to be shut down, a lot of the jobs are going to be let go. And that was a very emotional thing to do. But the one thing that I think really helped the success of that project was, one, executive buy-in and having them be a part of a lot of these key meetings where, you know, they're delivering that, you know, this change is going to happen. And to your point on the quick wins, you know, remind them of the quick wins. Yes, we're shutting down this contact center, but, you know, it's going to save us money and there's going to be new opportunities and things are going to be easier and better for the customers. So there's your quick wins. And then just remaining logical and not being overly emotional about the change initiative that's being announced. And then receiving other people's emotional response. I don't know if you've ever had to do that, where you just had to kind of receive their emotional response and you just listened and were empathetic. And I think that there's a place for that. But that's just one example where I think we successfully applied the change management model that Cotter came up with, put it into a repeatable process plan, had executive stakeholder communication, pointed out the quick wins, and really did it in our own way, and then learned from the first of those offices. And then every office we ran for shutting down just got better, and we were more experienced in doing it. So there's one example of it. But there were resistors, you know, and I'm sure you've seen resistors too, right? Where so you have some mid-level executive, or maybe they're a mid-senior, maybe they're even a senior executive, right? This is going to get some conversation going, Suzanne. Imagine this: you got somebody on the project, and like I said, they're senior at a large financial institution, so they're making a lot of money, and they've been there maybe 15, 20 years, and they're trying to resist the project. Literally resist. This isn't the right strategic. So they go around the authority that we have from executives to try to build other people to stop us. And they're kind of the, how dare you? I've been here 15, 20 years. This shouldn't be happening. I'm going to talk to these two, three people I know. We're going to have a meeting and we're going to shut this down. I'm going to ask you to just tell me, how do you respond to something like that?
Well, I think there is a number of options. One option is to let somebody more senior deal with it. So you escalate, because it might be beyond your level if it's a senior level director. Generally, I would respond the way I respond to people who are resistant, which is, as you said, receive it. Receive the emotional response and ask into it. Because first of all, it could be that they have a point. And it could be that we could learn something from it. But if it's a very senior person who is sabotaging it, I would probably make them understand as well that they're setting an example here. And if it is a strategy that their boss has bought into, is it then okay for this person to sabotage it? So I think there's a number of different ways around that one. None of them necessarily simple.
No, I mean, this is the biggest challenge of change management, because this happens, and I've seen it happen, which is when you announce it or when you're communicating it, really have those very senior executives, the ones that you can almost never get time with, announce it and show support of it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on. You need that very senior executive buy-in, because otherwise you really need the champion, because otherwise you will get other senior players who are going to challenge that decision. And I think you need to go back to those very senior sponsors and executives and have them have that conversation. Because if there's no order in their own ranks, then it's very difficult for lower levels of the organization to follow it.
So let's get back to talking about the pitfalls.
Yeah, because based on your example, I would say there are, you know, I've observed a number of pitfalls, and I think there are many, many pitfalls in change management, and they're really the ones I think we need to understand. So I think the biggest problem is people not recognizing that change management is important. People who, and I've seen this over and over again, there is not really a vision. Well, there is a vision, but it's not shared. It is not clear to people why we need to change. It's not clear to people, and when I say people, I mean the employees or the users, why this is important. What are the benefits for me in this? And the biggest problem, coming back to a point we mentioned before, is that we don't recognize that what people's basic needs are. So as a manager, I want this to be efficient. I want to implement change. And really, I just want, you know, if there were no employees, it would be so much easier, wouldn't it? If there were no end users, it would be so much easier to implement our project. So that pitfall is to not have the dialogue and to not build that trust, as you talked about. I mean, I have an example from a technical example. We had two trading systems that were merging in the bank where I was working a number of years ago. And that creates a lot of uncertainty for the two teams, because if you're merging two systems, one of the systems will have to be retired and decommissioned. And this was a rumor that was going in the organization for a long time. And staff, meaning the people working on those two systems, they became so uncertain that some of them began to leave. Because imagine this happened for over a 12, 18 months period. There was no decision. It wasn't communicated to staff what the vision was, how it was going to impact them. And it was just so poorly done. Somebody in management didn't realize, weren't able to empathize and make staff understand what the impact was of this, why we needed to rationalize. And it didn't have to be that way. They could have made this so much easier on everybody by being transparent, by bringing them into the process, and by creating that feedback loop. What do you guys think? How do you think we could do this? And so that's definitely an example of lots of pitfalls, lots of things that went wrong. And I have more examples if we want to go there.
The feedback loop that you point out is really, really important. That ties into the communication. Feedback is heard, because sometimes there may be good nuggets of information that can inform parts of the project that they're seeing the implications of on their business side, you know, which sometimes the execution of a project, you know, can be improved from that. Continue on with, you know, other stories. So you mentioned the pitfall, the two trading systems, the decommission. I get it. I've been on a lot of decommission projects. I know about that. give us another pitfall, something that with a good learning.
Yeah, so I have another story, which I think maybe will ring true for a lot of people. So we had a new manager join this organization I was working in. And this is years ago. And at the time, everybody needed to start using Agile. I mean, now we're further down the line, but back then, this is probably about 10 years ago, we needed to work in an Agile way. And we weren't really told why or what the benefits were, but this senior manager employed an Agile expert. And this Agile expert was supposed to come and work with the teams and let us know how to work differently. And I think so many things went wrong with that engagement because as an existing project manager and all the existing teams, we had the feeling that we weren't good enough the way we were doing things. I'm sure we could learn. Of course we could learn. But the way it was communicated to us, you know, there wasn't a nice vision. It wasn't explained to us why, what the benefits were to us of changing. Certainly, we weren't asked. There was no dialogue. We weren't asked what we felt, how we should engage with this Agile coach. And honestly, it created resistance. And in this example, I was part of the resistance. I was sitting there as a project manager. I'd worked in this place for a long time. I had my team, and I didn't like a consultant coming and telling me how I should be working differently. So this is now seeing it from a different point of view. And this consultant did something very clever. He realized that I was resistant to this, and he went up to me one day and he said, "Suzanne, can we have a cup of coffee?" And I was like, "Sure," you know, reluctantly agreeing. And we went down to have a coffee, and he said to me, "I sense that you're not too keen on what we're doing here." And I was partly shocked, partly relieved that he actually dared to mention it. You know, he was taking out this big white elephant and he was naming it. And I was able to express my concerns to him, and he was able to listen to me, and I guess you said it before, like receive my emotional response. And we had a really good conversation. And you know what? I respected him so much for bringing it up, for addressing it, because he was removing obstacles. He was listening to me. He was engaging me, and so it's a bad change story, which I think ended in a good way because somebody actually understood the process.
Kind of goes back to the whole, you know, team kickoff meeting and the rapport building and the socialization around food and drink to get people to let their defenses down. So I think that's what he did. And I've employed that tactic too. The best way that I'm able to get time with executives and to get them to hear, you know, what my ask is for a project is to do just that, have a cup of coffee with them and to really use that rapport and to be vulnerable. So that kind of brings up the vulnerability issue. What do you think the importance is of showing vulnerability?
I think that's a really good question. You know, projects are all about people. Change management is all about people. We get very caught up in process, and we need processes. We need just enough to deliver, but it's all about people. And vulnerability, I guess, is this word that up until a few years ago was not a word we would normally combine with business, but we are beginning to see the benefit of people showing vulnerability, which in my mind means somebody who can express that I don't have all the answers. I need you guys because together we can find the right answer. Somebody who can express I've made mistakes too, and it's okay for you also to make mistakes. And if we're going to figure this out, this big change, because most change projects, they involve quite a lot, then we need to figure it out together. It's that feedback loop. It's that consultation process. So great change projects have forums. They have a way where we can solicit that feedback from employees. And I think that we need then to, as managers, to be vulnerable enough and humble enough to ask for that feedback and to say, we haven't got it all figured out. We have the vision. We don't necessarily have all the stepping stones in getting there. So let's hear some of the ideas from you.
Right. Very well said. If I think of a change management consultant, you know, obviously some of your premier consultancies come to mind, Booz Allen, McKinsey, and Boston Consulting Group, et cetera, very respected change management strategy consulting firms. And the persona that those consultants typically have is, you know, very confident, very much, you know, mostly right, or having the attitude of I'm always right, I know a lot, because they're walking into the doors of the most powerful, most wealthy executives in all of corporate America and being advisors. And that in and of itself, that's very prestigious. But to your point about the vulnerability, and I think vulnerability is huge. And I know another guy, another author that, you know, maybe our audience knows, that's Keith Ferrazzi. You know, he wrote Never Eat Alone and Who's Got Your Back, two really interesting books on relationship management. But he talks a lot about vulnerability. And so that really talented, high-performing change management consultant persona that I just mentioned, do they show vulnerability with those Fortune 500 executives? And if they do, you know, how are they perceived? But I think the research on vulnerability, at least as I understand it from Keith's viewpoint, his book, is that they do really understand it. And when you're vulnerable with someone, they tend to be vulnerable with you. So I don't know how the details of that coffee meeting went with you, but if you just say, look, you know, I really don't know this, I'm struggling with this, and I think the project's going to have a failure here, you put that out there. And then they may come back to you and say, you know what, well, I failed here, I think we have an issue there. It just lets people put their defenses down and have a more candid conversation. And that's how you have a more innovative, collaborative conversation on how you really can implement the change. And that I think is where the big money can be had. And I think really good consultants can walk that. And we at Abstract Forward, we certainly do. So I just think that's a part of the hearts and minds strategy, you know? So if we have, this is kind of a different question, but if we say on change management best practices, knowing that it's mostly about people, knowing that it's mostly about communication, not so much about the technology or the bureaucracy or the processes. I have this measure of 60% hearts and 40% minds in change management as a strategy. In your view, is that generally accurate?
I think that's quite well put. I mean, maybe we shouldn't get too technical about it, because it's hard to measure, isn't it? But I see where you're coming from. And I think in project management and in change management even, there can be a lot of focus on the mind and not enough on the heart. So I like the fact that you're overshooting a bit on the heart side. It is, and also going back to what you said about vulnerability, I think we also have to consider the terminology we use when we are in this domain, because if we think of people who are not willingly accepting a change, we talk about them as opponents, or they're resisting, or they're obstacles. And by using that terminology, we almost imply that we have to go in with a toolbox, which is more on the mindset. We have to go in with a toolbox. We have to go in and tell them, this is the way we're going to do it, which is not showing vulnerability. We just, well, can't you just tell them that they need to do this, you know, which is more the pushing. We're going to push them. And people go in with a mind strategy or with a selling strategy. If you try to sell something to somebody, you're speaking to their mind. That's not going to make people overcome, to use the word resistance again. That's not going to make them more open, which is probably a better word. That's not going to make them more open to change. The openness comes from not pushing. Because if you have two magnets, you know, they're pushing against each other, at least if you turn the wrong end. So what we need is to remove that resistance, remove the accusations, remove the pushiness, and really open up a space where there is a possibility for people to contribute. And another thing I think that's interesting in the mind and the hearts is to go slower. Because, again, we have a tendency to want things tomorrow. And when we're talking about people, speed generally doesn't help in making people more open to a change. More time doesn't necessarily create openness either. But with more time, we can give, and the right consultation, we give people an opportunity to digest. And I use the word digest very deliberately, because there's something happening in our gut. We need to come to terms with and digest some of the things that are happening. You talked before about a rationalization program where people are going to lose their jobs. You know, that's something for people need to swallow it, to use another another metaphor. So if we sometimes go slower and stop pushing and take a little bit longer to consult with people, I think we will begin to speak more to the hearts and not just to the minds.
I agree. Sometimes going slow or at a medium pace is really the best way to ensure quality. Let people get comfortable with it. I think for projects and change management initiatives that are really being forced or rushed, they tend to fail or not be very successful. And that's not a good thing. And one thing that comes to mind, you know, when I think about this, is culture. You know, are we staying in line with our company culture? And the culture kind of informs how people are going to act on projects, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. So I guess this is the next topic that comes from change management, is culture. So in your experience, how have you seen culture be an effective part of change management?
Well, I think when an organization has an existing culture of wanting speed and efficiency over consultation or a collaborative approach, that is a way in which it can work against. But I do think that the cultures are changing. And I heard something very interesting recently from somebody who does a lot of work across Europe. And he said to me that the times are changing now, because up until very recently, it's been the employers who could set the agenda for the employees and who could demand people to work later or what and what not to do. But now it's more and more difficult. It's becoming more increasingly difficult in Europe to find talented people. This is what he said. And so we are beginning, and he's finding it difficult to recruit for his own businesses. And so his view is that it's beginning to change. We need to consult more. We need to provide more to our employees in order to attract them to our businesses. And I think this is part of a change in culture, because that, you know, the younger generations, they don't just want to work on projects. They want to work on projects that have meaning and purpose, more and more so. They ask, more so than any other generation, why am I doing this? Why? What's the purpose? And so I think that's part of a changing in culture, where executives are being forced to be more open, more collaborative, and to think things through better, and to also work on projects, I'm hoping and partly hoping, partly believing, that are also serving the world. Because I think that's another trend we're seeing, that we need projects that are actually helping us to progress as a, you know, sustainable, in a sustainable manner. So I think, not sure if that completely answers your question, but I think there's a lot happening on the cultural side that eventually could help us implement change better.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm going to give a hypothetical example, but has some real world relevance. And that is the automotive industry and the traditional combustion engine versus the emerging electric or other newer energy source vehicle, right? So if I think about the culture of the traditional Detroit-based automotive manufacturing scene, that's a certain type of culture, you know. And if I think about the Toyota manufacturing process, which, you know, arguably developed lean, or at least inspired at Toyota, is very famous for, you know, being behind the lean manufacturing revolution, being very effective, dollar and cent measurements. They didn't waste money. They're very effective. They had robots doing a lot of the manufacturing, the cutting of the metals, and they were extremely, extremely effective. So that they could have a low price and reasonably good quality on the vehicles that they produced, as Kimbo, in the 1980s. So there was a culture there. There's a different culture with, you know, the Detroit auto manufacturers, which were heavily, mostly all American-based autos, right? And It's not to say that they didn't focus on quality. They just weren't as automated with it, and they didn't have the lean processes, and so it was a different culture. And now what we're seeing is this the growth of Tesla, which is a totally different culture, which is, you know, we're designing cars with computers and software in every part of the car. And the biggest cultural thing here is, how do we overcome the traditional way of thinking around the economics of the combustion engine, right? So this is a big change management issue. How do we get a better, more energy efficient vehicle for less? And can we overcome the culture that is embedded, you know, the combustion engine automakers, and there's a whole lobby there. You understand what I'm saying? This is an interesting problem. Mm. There's been a lot of research on it, but I think this will be a big case study in change management at some time. You know, so if you're Ford or if you're, you know, Chevy, and you're saying, well, we have a change management initiative, we're gonna take Tesla on head on. We're gonna literally change our whole model to be electric based car manufacturing instead of, you know, combustion engine. That is a hard thing to do.
Yes, and what you need there, you need the top to buy into it as well as people further down. And what will probably happen is that some people are not going to make it, and there will be a grace period. And if some people are still resistant, what's going to happen? They're going to change people until you get that critical mass of people who are buying into a new way of doing things. It can be helped or it can be hindered, but I think inevitably in every business there will be some people who, even with a good hearts and minds strategy, potentially cannot be won over.
Oh, you're totally right, and that this kind of gets to another part of change management which we have danced around but haven't really talked about, and that is the collateral damage, meaning that we're doing a huge, huge, drastic, controversial change. In the case I'm given here, hypothetically, we're going from automotive combustion engine manufacturing to complete electric or some other renewable energy. We may lose 30% of our workforce. We may almost go bankrupt. So that's another thing about change, and particularly leadership in change management, is that you might almost be on the edge of failure before you're successful with the change. Have you seen that to be true?
I think I don't know if this is more. I haven't seen it, and I'm guessing it's because it's more in manufacturing. Could be more in manufacturing where you have certain products. You need to renew your products. Working in financial services, which I did for many years, there was not the same need for innovation, because I think what you're talking about here is also the need to innovate and to stay abreast of market opportunities. And so some companies, you know, talk about Kodak or whatever, they went out of business because they weren't innovating. Other companies, blockbusters, all of a sudden they go out of business because for some reason they don't stay abreast with competition. I have not experienced that in the businesses I've been in, fortunately.
If we look at Saturn, that tried to make the electric car and failed, it almost brought the whole Chevy company bankrupt. Right, Saturn was making a electric car, and they stopped doing it. And they said that they stopped doing it because it was too harmful to their business model. Really, I think because a lot of the people in the combustion engine establishment, the supply chain people, all the different interests that were getting a part of the money, had influence over that change, and it was a little early at the time, as well. So. Generally, the broad point I'm making is that when people are behind really big change management initiatives, it is so hard, it is so controversial that it might almost bankrupt you, or you may be bankrupt for a while. You know what I'm saying? You're so close to that failure that it almost would make you give up. And that's truly visionary change management, visionary leadership behind those types of initiatives. Once you're really successful with it, then people jump on board. But, you know, Amazon is another example. In the early years of Amazon, they were almost bankrupt. They almost didn't make it in the early years of internet commerce because it didn't take off right away. And, you know, they had a lot of issues scaling. They're really successful now, but back then, not so much. some companies have a culture of constant learning, of constant change. And I think probably one of those companies is Apple. And maybe Amazon too. I think both those companies have a really fast learning, really fast change culture there. And I would say some of your more traditional manufacturing companies and consumer packaged good companies, they don't. And it's because the business model is different, but.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that the most successful companies, they change all the time. Change is constant, and it will become more and more of a constant because technological changes are happening quicker and quicker. And I think it's also interesting that we were talking before about the collateral damage. So in one way, yes, we have to create the vision. We have to follow Kotter's some or all of his steps. We have to create the dialogue to overcome resistance, win over hearts and minds, all the rest of it. But there comes a point where there are some people who are very difficult to win over, even with a lot of goodwill. And there's also something that change management experts talk about, which is we need to create a burning platform. So when you create a burning platform, it means that I cannot stay where I currently am because there is no future where I am at the moment. So I'm having to go digital, or I'm having to use agile, or whatever the change is that the company is introducing, I am having to employ it. And so companies also need to make sure that there is no future associated with the status quo. And embedding that culture, as you're saying, of constant change. But I think we can only embed a culture of constant change if employees are not fearing it. Because if it's unpleasant, if I'm associating change with, oh my God, I'm not being trained. Oh my God, it's going to be chaotic. Oh my God, I have no clue what's going to happen. I'm probably going to, some people are going to be laid off. We're not going to be told about it. Then there will be a fear culture associated with change. But it can, if we change that around to say, okay, change is constant. We have to continuously evolve and develop our products and our methods. And there is opportunity for everybody. Let's have a dialogue about how this can benefit you, how this can benefit each of us, how this allows us to be more competitive or whatever it is. So I think it's all in how it is done and how that engagement happens. And if we make it okay to talk openly about how we're feeling, what we're expecting, and for management to have the capacity to embrace that. But of course, we can't sit around and just talk all day either. There also needs to be the direction and the vision. So it's not simple at all.
Wow, that was really well said. And this kind of reminds me of the quick wins part of it. With the collateral damage or the communication challenges that we've talked about, and then having those offline coffee meetings to build rapport and to show vulnerability, there's a place for quick wins. Talk about where you see the placement of quick wins in a change initiative.
I think that's a great question. I think quick wins can be used very strategically, although it's a tactical way of doing it. Because if you go out there and you have a little quick win to show some benefit to somebody, it's potentially one of the best ways of showing the benefit. So have somebody play with something. Have a little, not sure what example to use, but give the user something that they can use so that they get a sense of what this is all about. And I think quick wins, it can be used, depending on whether we're talking about a consumer good or whether we're talking about a process. It can also be to create a prototype or a mock-up or something visual or a draft or a whatever it is, create something that people can see and feel and interact with or give them something of benefit, because that's what's going to win people over, not a concept, not a talk, something they can see for themselves and validate that is working. And also think sometimes, you know, we used to talk in project management about, you know, gradual change or big bang, you know. If you develop things gradually, and I think this is the one of the big advantages of Agile, the incremental change, the incremental implementations, is that you can demonstrate the benefits to the users quicker. Beginning with a quick win and then building on that, or beginning with a prototype and then making that prototype a fully fledged product that's working. So I'm a big believer in starting slow, gaining momentum, gaining feedback and improving it, and then all of a sudden people are part of the change, which is one of the keys as well to change management. Make people part of the change, and you can do that if you give them a quick win, ask for feedback, or have a prototype, get feedback on it. I think that's the way to go.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I remember being on projects where we were the strategy was to identify the biggest thorn in the project, because whatever project you're on, there's always going to be somebody who's your biggest thorn, you know, your biggest naysayer, your biggest hater, your biggest objector, your biggest problem. There always will be. And then there's going to be your biggest supporter, you know, your biggest champion. And what I've found is that it's usually not the people you think that it's going to be. And so with this quick win that we've been talking about, I think if you can give that biggest thorn a quick win, just, you know, kind of give them a quick win. They're too busy with the attention of the quick win to be angry at the change initiative. You know what I mean? So that can be a strategy, and I think that can work pretty effectively, particularly for, you know, those mid-level executives who have egos, insecurities, and want to play the office politics game, like we talked about in the early part of the call, where they're trying to, you know, use their little coalition of people via office politics and back channel pettyism. But that happens. That's the reality of American business and project management and change management. It happens every day, all day long, and it's not going to stop. And the way you deal with that is use the quick win, give it to them, make them look good. And then they're less incentivized to, you know, use back channels to try to detract from the project. And to your point earlier, if they are trying to detract from the project in that way, which isn't ethical, isn't mature, but they do it, document it, and make sure we have that high up executive sponsor that's, you know, checking in on the calls, not every single call because they're too busy. And you know, every single call, you know, that minimizes legitimacy, but every now and then. Another thing is email communication. I would have, you know, if things are getting dicey, if people aren't attending meetings, if some people are resisting to the change, well, got to have an email communication from that really high up executive. I mean, way up there, saying, look, and mention your name. And I've had them do that too, where they mention me and what I'm doing and, you know, the people that I'm working with and how this is supported. That can be a good way to reinforce that change.
Yeah. Naming that behavior and calling it out, you do talk about emails, but I would also say face-to-face is extremely powerful, because some people get away with it just as long as they can get away with it. As long as nobody mentions it, they think that, oh, you know. So calling it out and actually having the courage to face up to somebody, even if they're more senior, and saying, you know, when you don't turn up to meetings or when you don't sign things off, is giving me the feeling that you don't support our initiative or that you have something else in mind or whatever it is, actually having the guts to say it without accusation, just playing back and naming what the behavior is that we're observing as project managers and change agents. I think that's incredibly powerful.
I've done it and I've seen really good PMs do it, and it's hard.
Sorry, I can tell you why it's so hard. From my point of view, it's so hard because it requires a lot of self-confidence. And as a coach, I know how many people suffer from self-confidence issues. It's one of those things that I just wish that more people would believe in themselves and would not have fear or freeze around people who are more senior, because most often they can sense what the right thing is, but they want to please, they're afraid of conflict, and so they hold themselves back, and it's a real shame.
I agree with you. I mean, you and I agree on a lot of things, but the issue is that if you confront that senior person, they may try to end your consulting gig, because I've seen it happen. They'll use their ego. It depends on who they are. I've done it a few times, and then I've even got feedback after it where people were like, well, why are you questioning this person? You know what I mean? So don't do it. Don't do it on a call. Do it privately. Mm. Don't do it in an accusatory manner, like you said. I mean, you said well how it should be done, but it's still hard, and it needs to be done, and it's going to be happening on every change initiative. And I think the other thing is, don't necessarily do it alone. If you have a key stakeholder on the project that you're working regularly with, and you will, and I know I have, they should be in there with you. It's just another person to reinforce what you're saying. And then put it in the context of, we want to help you. We want to understand what roadblocks you have on your view. Because from that person's viewpoint of the business line or whatever part they're in, there may be things that are happening to their organization that they need to share the impact of. Unless you really hear from that person their viewpoint of the impact, you may not understand it like you think you do. So that's kind of the dependencies, right? There's lots of different dependencies on projects, and there's impacts, and those dependencies are viewed different from the eyes of those overseeing those business areas. And you know, I've had a lot of experience with that. But I want to get back to your books, because you are an author, you know, you are a thought leader. So, you know, we're coming up on the end of the call here, but just tell our audience about your books. Where can they find those books, et cetera?
Yeah, so the first one, which is from 2012 now, it goes back a little bit, is called The Project Management Coaching Workbook. I think it's only people in the US who can get hold of it by now, because it's kind of running out of print. But the publisher still has a few copies. I tend to use more my second book at the moment, which is The Power of Project Leadership, which is really, I would say, exclusively about the people side of project management. It's not titled change management, because to me, it's all about understanding psychology. I lump it all under leadership, to be honest, because for me, leadership is about understanding people. It's about leading with vision. It's about innovation. It's about gaining buy-in for what we do. It's about winning people over. So all of that I actually lump under leadership, and I think it's good leaders who are good change agents. So that book is available on Amazon in electronic form and in a soft copy as well. And it's done really well. It's been translated into Chinese as well. So not sure where that came from. And I think I'll be doing a second edition at some point.
Wow. Well, great. I'm going to make sure to link that out on the summary here. And I'll make sure to get myself a copy of that. I read a lot of leadership books. I know a lot of my audience and clients, they are leaders. And so they're always trying to better understand the leadership landscape and how to influence change. But as we end this podcast, I want to have a summary. So I'm going to give you some time here for our audience of CIOs, CISOs, CEOs, business owners, investors, and very senior consultants. What is your advice, you know, as an author around change management and change project leadership?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So in summary, I would say that change management is about psychology, it's about people. And if we believe that we can cut corners by delivering something faster and smarter by pushing things through, then we have to think it over again, because it's not going to happen. We have to win people over. We have to win over the hearts and the minds. And we do that best by having a clear vision, communicating that vision. But I think more so, or of course, in addition to having that consulting approach, where we sit with people, where we create forums, where we create feedback loops, where we're able to hear from people on the ground, how are you experiencing this? Because if people are fearful, they will reject the change and it will not be a success, because change projects isn't just about delivering a thing. It's about people having to adopt that and use that change. And that can only happen if they truly buy into it with their hearts.
Well said. Well, thank you so much for being here, Suzanne. It was great to hear your insight and some of the stories that you've experienced in your career around project leadership, change management, and the like. And for our audience, again, this is Jeremy Swenson. I'm CEO of Abstract Forward Consulting. We are a cybersecurity management consulting firm. We cover process improvement, change management, CIO, CISO strategy advisement, and our guest here is Susan Madsen, and she is a change management and project leadership author and consultant and coach. And our topic has been change management. So with that, I'd just like to thank our audience, thank Suzanne, and you will catch us next time.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for having me on your podcast.